All right, so this is Jeff Wendahl, and what do we have today? We have a Mastery Teach Call, and we brought in Eric Stewart, and a lot of people have met him at the Multifamily Millions Boot Camp. He's been part of our power team for years, and he's like, the best thing about Eric is he gets deals closed, you know, so I highly recommend him. But also what we're going to do, we're going to bring some clarity to some topics that we had, that like non-recourse loans, yield maintenance, loan assumptions, bad boy clauses, how they all tie together. So as we go along, if you have any questions, just press star zero, and we'll get the operator will take your name in, and we'll put you in the queue, and we'll make sure we get your answers questions answered. And if you have anything else typical on the London market itself, like Eric is just like he's right there. He has a pulse on everything that's going on right now in the industry on what to carry, what to underwrite at. So we'll do that. And like so what I'll do is I'm going to be on the line, but like I'll turn it over to you, Eric. I'll let you take it away.
Sounds good, Jeff. Thanks. Appreciate the info. Thanks, everybody, for letting me come on the call and kind of share with you what I'm seeing out there. As Jeff said, I've been working with the group for a number of years now, and a lot of what we do on the debt side is Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or CMBS. You know, it's securitized debt. So that's what I wanted to. That's what we were going to talk about today. Is kind of go over some of the characteristics that you see when you place securitized debt on your property. So first, again, like Jeff said, my name is Eric Stewart. My company is Atlantic Business Capital. I'm a mortgage broker, so I've probably met a fair amount of you at different multifamily million boot camps around the country. And as I said there, you know, I don't actually write the check, but I do have a stable of lenders that do write checks. You know, everything from short-term bridge loans all the way up to long-term permanent debt. So we offer the debt side. We've also got some equity solutions as well. I've got some groups that come in and do offer, the equity piece for the right deal. That's on a case-by-case basis as well. So essentially, the call today, that there were some specific areas that Jeff wanted to hit and Jeff wanted to share with you. And when we look at what those specifics are, what those characteristics were, they all come back to securitized debt. And those characteristics that he wanted to touch on were non-recourse financing and the carve-outs that are associated with non-recourse debt. He wanted to talk about prepayment penalties, specifically yield maintenance, and there's also defeasance there, but yield maintenance and defeasance. And then he also wanted to connect on loan assumptions and what's involved, what are some of the quirks, some of the positives and negatives of assuming a loan. So those are the areas that we're gonna talk about. But bigger picture, when you see those characteristics, you should know that they're typically associated with a loan that is going to be securitized, meaning there's going to be an investor on the other side of that loan. So the same way you've syndicators go out and raise equity, and you've got investors that are buying into your deal, your lender has investors that are actually buying that debt. And so your loan, along with a bunch of other loans, is pooled and sold in the secondary market. Everybody's familiar with CMBS or commercial mortgage-backed security by now, but Fannie does the same thing, Freddie does the same thing. Obviously they're huge, buyers of debt in the secondary market. Well, what's important to note on this is that when the loan is securitized and there's an investor there, they're guaranteed a certain return. So they've got to have some assurances in place that that investor is going to get the return or the yield that was promised to them. Whereas portfolio lenders, you know, they hold it on their books, and they're, a lot of times they're really weighted towards the fees that are associated with the loan. So your depository lenders, your local banks, they're fee in, they generate fee income, so they like to turn that money. And typically, they're not going to offer you as long of a fixed period because they want that money back in to keep up with market rates. So that's just a couple differences when you see portfolio lender relative to a securitized lender. Higher prepayment penalties, longer fixed periods, and the loans are typically non-recourse. So when we say non-recourse, there's a couple different attributes to that recourse, non-recourse aspect. One is the liability. Obviously, it's they're not coming after your personal assets to make themselves whole. But two, they're also not looking at your income to service the debt. And that's very important because when you present a loan application to a depository lender, a local bank, they typically look for a couple years tax returns, and then they look at the income of the property, and they combine those two characteristics to see how well you can make that payment. Well, when we do these non-recourse or securitized loans, which by the way typically start right around $1 million loan amount. Some of my Fannie lenders will go down to 750, but usually it's around $1 million or more, and that's generally an 80% loan to value. So purchase price of around 125, 1.3 is kind of that floor for the small balance program. But nonetheless, they're not looking at your income when you're doing these non-recourse loans. They're not looking at your income to service the debt. They're just looking at the income of the property. So there's two separate characteristics. Relative to the liability, even though it's considered a non-recourse loan, there are certain events or instances where the lender defines, they're defined by the lender that they can come after you personally, or it would become a recourse loan. It would trigger the recourse. And those are called carve-outs. They're carve-outs to the non-recourse guarantee. And for the most part, they're going to vary a little bit from lender to lender, but there's some generalities between your carve-outs that they always touch on. And it usually is defined by fraudulent activity or negligent activity, something that would harm the asset or harm the lender or defraud the lender in some way. So they're also referred to as bad boy clauses. You'll hear that term a lot, carve-outs or bad boy clauses. A common term that a lender is going to use when they talk about their key principles or they reference their key principles is, okay, who's signing on my carve-outs? Who's signing the carve-outs on this loan? Because those are the people that are the warm bodies, they refer to them. Those are the warm bodies that are actually standing behind that loan, or also referred to as the key principle. So again, even though they're non-recourse loans, there are certain circumstances. Let's say you dump toxic waste on the property, or you embezzle funds. If you don't use the property for its intended use at the time you make the loan, they can come after you personally. Let's say the property is approved and run and underwritten as a multifamily property, and you have some other purpose for it as soon as you buy it and get the loan. Although gray, that is a carve out in some lender's documentation where it would trigger a recourse guarantee. Another one also is some administrative stuff. If you were to come back and not make your first payment, considered a first payment default, that's another area where they can come after you personally. And my Freddie Mac lenders or Freddie Mac small balance program, they will use the carve outs in lieu of actually collecting for certain reserves. So it's a really nice feature. My Freddie small balance guys don't collect for insurance escrows. They don't collect for replacement reserves. And as long as it's not too extreme, they usually don't collect for immediate repairs. You know, but what they will do is include those in the recourse guarantee, so or the carve-outs, we'll say. So they'll include those in the carve-outs and say, hey, you know, if you don't make these repairs in a certain time frame, they're subject to personal liability. Or, you know, if you don't keep up your insurance on the property or pay your taxes, you know, it's subject to personal liability. So yeah, they do utilize those carve-outs to maintain some assurance that those items are going to get paid. Other lenders, while they still may be included in the carve-outs, other lenders just collect them. You know, my Fannie guys collect for replacement reserves, they collect for insurance and immediate repairs. But it's a nice feature on the Freddie small balance side where they don't. So they give you that control to do that. So are there any, I know that Jeff had mentioned, we want to give you folks an opportunity to ring in if you have specific questions. And rather than waiting until the end of the call, we're going to do it section by section. So relative to these carve-outs, I wanted to give everybody an opportunity to ring in and see if you had any questions before I go on to a different subject. So feel free to do that now.
Yeah, just press star zero. And let's see if the operator has any questions right now. Operator, are there any questions in the queue right now?
Yes, there's one. We have Roger with a question. Roger, please go ahead.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Eric. Roger from sunny Southwest Florida. How are you guys?
Hey, Roger.
Good.
How are you?
Good. I have a question on escrows. You've sort of touched on it. I understand Fannie Mae requires escrows and Freddie Mac does not require escrows. And the significance of this is if, for example, you need $100,000 in CapEx, then with Fannie Mae, you have to have 125% of that $125,000 put in escrow. So you actually need to raise an extra $225,000 because you have to do the work first and then apply to get your escrow back. Am I correct that Fannie requires that and Freddie Mac does not?
You're correct that Fannie Mae does require it with a 25% overage contingency. Freddie Mac does not do that for normal deferred maintenance. However, if there are material life safety issues or if there is an extensive repair budget that is needed, they have required it in the past. So they reserve the right to do that for extreme situations, but in general, they don't collect for light deferred maintenance.
Okay, thank you. I mean, it's a big difference to the required capital we have to raise. Thank you, guys.
Sure thing, Roger. Thanks for the question.
Okay, operator, are there any other questions?
We have no further questions at the moment.
Okay.
Okay.
If you have a question, just press star zero.
All right, great. Well, moving on to the other character, some of the other characteristics that we were talking about. Real quick, we talked about the fee income that portfolio lenders like to generate, and they want to, a lot of times they'll want to get the money back in, get that loan paid off so they can put it back out on the street at current market rates. Well, when we're looking to hedge against rising rates, a lot of my clients do want those longer fixed periods, 10 years, 15 years, 12 years, things like that. And with that, in order to get an investor or entice an investor to leaving their money out there for that length of time, there's got to be some assurance that the loan is not going to be paid off or that they are going to receive the yield that they're tying their money up for, because it's not a liquid investment for them. And with these securitized loans, Fannie, Freddie, and CMBS, you've got two forms of prepayment penalty. You've got yield maintenance and you've got defeasance. Now, both of them are typically quite expensive. Obviously, as market rates increase, and I'll go into detail in just a minute, but as market rates increase, the yield maintenance and defeasance prepays, they are reduced, But in general, they're typically more expensive than, say, what we would call a step-down prepay, which a step-down prepay is where you, if you pay it off early, you're going to pay a percentage of that loan balance, and that percentage is going to be reduced every year or every other year by 1 or 2 percentage points. So the longer you keep the loan, the lower the prepay. When it comes to yield maintenance, it's rather self-explanatory. You're going to maintain the yield to that investor that you promised them in the beginning. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a $5 million loan, and it's a 10-year term. So you do a $5 million loan, say it's a $6.2 million purchase, $5 million loan, and it's a 10-year term. Well, you want to sell that property in year 3. Normal amortization, 30-year AM, you're going to have a balance of around $4.75 million. So you go through the sale, you close, you give that lender that $4.75 million payoff. And it is up to them to go out into the marketplace and reinvest that 4.75 so that they can give their investors the 5% that you promised them, right? Well, if they can only give them, and let's say the market is in a position where they can only give them, say, a 2.5% return, then you, as a borrower, make up that other 2.5% for every year that is remaining on the term. So that 2.5% would be paid, you'd have to make that up in the form of a yield maintenance prepayment penalty for the remaining term. So you can see where that would get extremely expensive. And as market rates increase, if they could go and make 3%, then your prepayment penalty would be a yield maintenance penalty of 2% per year. So you can see how it moves right in line with market fluctuation. So when you try and predict what your prepay would be at a certain point, it's rather difficult to do because we don't know where market rates are going to be at that time. But it can get real complicated if you let it, but the end result is yield maintenance is maintaining the yield that you promised them. So you give them your payoff, they go in the market and invest it. Typically it's in treasuries, very safe investment. And you pay the difference between what they can make and what you promised them. So that's yield maintenance in a very simple nutshell. You're going to see defeasance as another prepayment penalty, and it's essentially the same type of theory of maintaining the yield or still giving them that 5% or whatever the percentage rate is. But when you hear a defeasance prepay, one that's usually associated with a CMBS loan, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are yield maintenance. Defeasance is usually found with a conduit lender or a CMBS structure. And that means that instead of paying that difference, as in the example, that 2.5% difference, you would take the payoff, and again, we're using an example of, we did a $5 million loan on a 10-year term, and we're trying to pay it off, we'd like to pay it off in year 3. Well, you take that 4.75 balance and use that to purchase enough treasuries or enough securities to make that payment. So instead of having the property there, you know, you're selling the property. The property is going to go on to whoever's buying it. So you have to replace that property with treasury bonds. And whatever that costs, you've got to pay the difference between that and your mortgage balance. So it's kind of a substitution of collateral. You're doing the same thing, you're maintaining the yield, but instead of having the property there as collateral for that loan, you substitute that with treasury bonds. And those bonds have to make enough money to make the payment on the loan. So it's a little bit more complicated. You will hire a firm to defease the loan, or defease that loan structure. And at the end of the day, it again is quite expensive. And it's the actual cost is dependent on where market rates at the time. But those are the two types of prepayment penalties that you're going to see associated with these Fannie loans and Freddie Mac loans and CMBS loans. Now, on the small balance programs for both Fannie and Freddie, there are circumstances where they offer a step-down prepayment penalty. And you know, your standard prepay for a Freddie Mac small balance loan starts at 5% and reduces down to 1% through the term of the loan. You can have you can get a lower interest rate with Freddie Mac if you choose a yield maintenance prepayment penalty. You can also reduce your prepayment penalty and go with a lower step down, and that's going to raise your interest rate a bit. So you've got some really nice options with Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae, on deals that are 50 units or less, will offer you a step down prepay as well. Typically there are yield maintenance, but on 50 units or less, they will offer you a step down. So you do have some options there also. So just in general, keep in mind that when you see a yield maintenance prepay, it very well may be an agency loan. When you see a defeasance prepay, it is most likely a CMBS loan. And with these small balance deals, they also offer step down. So it could be a small balance Freddie or small balance Fannie. So, you know, any questions on those prepays? Before I go on to the next section, I want to make sure that we touch on any areas that might not be clear. I know it can get a little bit complicated, but hopefully we're keeping it as general as possible. Are there any questions on the two types of prepayment penalties that we just talked about?
We have one question from Paul.
Hi.
Paul, please go ahead.
Hi, it's Paul Williams from Marble Falls, Texas. And the question isn't really about the deferred maintenance or the defeasance, but it's about like the small business loans. I've heard other investors telling me that the way that they buy their larger commercial properties, specifically hotels, they use a small business loan, and somehow it works out better for them than like a Fannie or a Freddie or something like that. Can you elaborate that, or I don't know if you were going to talk about that.
Well, when we talk about the loan types, I guess it's important to differentiate between the two. The small business loans, or the loans that fall under that SBA category, the Small Business Administration category, that is different. Those are owner-occupied properties, which, you know, a hotel would be considered an owner-occupied property. They also do loans that don't have any real estate associated with them at all. They have, typically when you do SBA loans, you see a 504, which is a two-piece, a first and a second mortgage, and then you have a 7A, SBA 7A loan, which is one loan, but a lot of times there's no real estate associated with that 7A loan. The SBA loans are what they're most likely referring to when they talk about doing hotels or owner-occupied businesses, things like that. You know, you want to buy an accounting firm, or you want to buy a restaurant, or a hotel, as you said. That is SBA, Small Business Administration, 504 or 7A. And those are recourse, personal guarantees required, tax returns, heavy paperwork. You know, they're a great alternative, and a lot of your depository lenders want you to take that SBA route because they can put a loan out there, and then they have an SBA guarantee behind them. So it's really nice for the banks, you know, the FDIC banks where you keep your deposits and everything. Now, for multifamily, those are considered investment properties. And the types of loans that we're looking at that we're talking about here are, they're Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, but they are small balance loans. So it's defined by the loan amount itself, and that would be for Fannie Mae, it's from $750,000 to $5 million. For Freddie Mac, it's from $1 million to $6 million. And in their top markets, which are, you know, your major MSAs, then they go up to $7.5 million. So the difference between the two, and what I think the other folks that you're talking about that you mentioned are referring to, is an SBA loan, Small Business Administration, for owner-occupied properties, or owner-occupied properties or businesses. And then we're talking about a small balance loan program issued. Both Fannie Mae has one, Freddie Mac has one, and that's defined by the loan amounts themselves. So does that clarify a little bit for you?
Yeah, I think so. It's clear as mud. Got it.
Okay.
I understand it better than I did before. Thank you.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're not going to do hotels. They're not going to do hospitality. And typically the SBA is not going to do multifamily because hotels are considered owner-occupied properties. You know, you're running that business. Multifamily properties are considered investment properties, and the SBA is not going to do investment stuff. So there's a little bit of overlap there when you get into, say, USDA programs in very rural areas that is governed by the SBA. Sometimes they'll do multifamily properties, but that's not your mainstream program. So two separate loan types or two separate types of assets. So that's it.
Thank you.
Any other questions on defeasance and yield maintenance? Or step-down prepays?
There are no further questions at the moment.
Okay. All right. Well, moving on, as we said, a lot of these prepayment penalties can get rather expensive. And, you know, and we see properties appreciate, we see markets change. A lot of times, you know, in this, one of these things about these long-term fixed structures is that they're not incredibly liquid. You know, when you buy, you know, single families and the fix and flips and all that kind of stuff, a lot of my investors really like the liquidity from that type of investment. When we start buying multifamily, it's a longer term hold. It's, you know, one of those plan your work your plan kind of things where you don't have access to that capital. So, you know, on a 10-year term, you may want to get out early. And you've got this huge yield maintenance or defeasance prepayment penalty staring you in the face, which really would seem quite crippling or quite limited. Well, one of the ways that you can get out of this loan and sell this property is to have your new buyer come in and assume that loan. Now, it's not just, you know, non-qualified assumable where you can just originate the loan and then stick anybody else in there to take it over. They've got to qualify for it. But that is the most common way you're going to see someone avoid this prepayment penalty, is just to have somebody come in and assume the loan. Now, that we see more and more of them, and Jeff and I were just talking about this right before the call, with where rates have been at historic lows, everybody's, you know, they've taken out longer terms, and as they want to sell them, you know, the prepays are really, really heavy. So we're seeing more assumptions now than we have in a long time. And there's some nuances to it that are different than a new origination. You know, the standard guidelines for the loan programs, they do have to meet those. I mean, as we come in and the borrower that's assuming the loan, or the new buyer, they refer to them as a proposed borrower. And the proposed borrower, they do have to meet your normal guidelines that we always talk about, your net worth greater than the loan amount, that type of thing. But because there's already a borrower in place, because the loan has already been approved for a certain borrower, for a certain business plan, that type of thing, it's a little bit more of a custom approval process. And a common term that you're going to hear when you get into assumptions is that, you know, you have to be stronger than your seller. You know, and that's not always the case. It's quite common that they want to they compare you to the net worth and the liquidity and the overall credit structure of the seller, because again, that's how the loan was approved. But it's not cut and dry that you have to come in with a heavier net worth, more experience, that type of thing. It's referred to as the Bill Gates theory. What if you're buying a property from Bill Gates? How are you going to come in and show more strength than him? So what they do is they look at the overall asset, you know, and they look at your strength and what you're bringing to the table. You know, a lot, it's very much case by case, where you may have an intimate knowledge of that market. You may bring real solid cash flow or a lot of fresh powder into the deal where you're planning on making a lot of renovations. You might own a lot of other property in the market, and you're just better suited for that property than the existing borrower. So in that scenario, even though you may not have a higher net worth or you know, personal liquidity or something like that, we've had success in getting those assumptions done. So just keep that in mind. It's a little bit more of a custom job. The standard guidelines are there. I mean, that's always going to be the baseline. But they do compare you, good and bad, to the existing borrower. In general, you know, our new originations take anywhere from 45 days to 60 days from the time we make application to the time we close. And assumptions they're usually longer. Once again, it has a lot to do with kind of getting off of that standard formula for an approval that you would see on a new origination, and you know, presenting it to multiple layers of approval. Because as this loan gets securitized, you know, you've got different structures that have to review it, and you know, it may get purchased, and it's going to get purchased in the secondary market in different pieces. You've got an A piece and a B piece, and so it gets what's called bifurcated or split up, basically. And as you request this assumption and you request to take over this loan, there's multiple approvals that need to come into play. So this is what can take some time. You know, you go back through your originator, the lender that first originated the loan, and they build the package. You know, they put the business plan together, they do the preliminary work, and they build this loan submission. A lot of times the servicer is going to hire a third party to go internally build that. And then you present that to the master servicer, and you present it to the trust where that holds this pool of loans, and you've got to get approval from these layers of approval done. So this is why it can typically take longer than a new origination. For most of these loans, for Fannie, Freddie, your conduit loans, there's usually a 1% assumption fee associated with this with the transaction, and normal third party fees would apply as well. Even though a lot of times they don't have to get a new appraisal, you know, the asset is already on their books, they're still going to review it. They're still going to want a kind of refresher on what's going on with the asset, and you're still going to have your typical third-party expenses that are associated with it. And one of the things you want to look for when you consider assuming a loan is whether or not it can be assumed again. In most cases, they can be assumed multiple times, but you want to look at the history of it and see what assumption you're on and how many times that loan can be assumed. So was there any questions on loan assumptions? And anything I've touched on so far that's sparked any further questions?
Yeah, I got two questions that were emailed in.
We have one left.
You have one?
Just one.
All right, we'll let that person go. Okay, so they're the one that emailed it in too, so there'll be more clarity on the question. Go ahead.
Okay, next question comes from Mark. Mark, please go ahead.
Yeah, this is... Hi, Jeff and Eric. This is Mark on the ground in Houston.
Oh, my God, Mark. Are you Mark S?
Mark F. still buying apartments and on the ground in Houston. Love the program. So, some good information, Eric. My question is, why can't you, on these loan assumptions, what makes the loan assumable? Is there a due on sale clause there? Or why can't you just put the property into a land trust and go ahead and step into the shoes of the original buyer and just service that note as the trustee or management company and to take put the property in a land trust and service that note without an assumption?
Well, are you gonna change the guarantor structure of the loan?
Well, typically when you deed the property to a land trust, that would change the guarantor, but it's I'm just curious. I've done it with smaller loans with banks.
Well, if you have signed loan docs as essentially acted as a key principal with on behalf of the borrower, right? You've got your borrowing entity, your LLC, that owns this asset. And if you change ownership of that asset, you've got to go through your lender to let them know what's going on. So if you're going to if there's going to be some type of change of the guarantor structure, your lender's going to have to approve that. And yes, if you're going to change the ownership of it, that always has to get approved by your lender. So that's what I've seen.
Typically they're owned in LLCs, correct?
Correct.
And if they are, could you just swap out the membership interest and sell that membership interest to your new buyer without a loan assumption as well?
It would depend on how much of a membership interest you would sell. You've got a trigger in your loan docs. It's going to vary, but in most cases, you've got to notify the lender of any transfer of ownership at all, and anything over 25% is subject to lender approval.
That's the typical language in these type loans?
Correct.
And typically the properties are owned by an LLC, but if you wrap it with a land trust, then
wrap
you could
it
just
with a land trust. Wrap it with a land trust.
You question, typically the LLC is your IRS tax return. A land trust has no tax return. It's just it becomes a private and confidential title that you can wrap your LLC with. And then you simply swap out the trustee is another thought. It doesn't sound like it's really done at this size level alone. I've done it with smaller properties, but I'm just curious.
I can tell you it's something that's going to impact the control of the asset, and that would in that scenario that would trigger a lender. You would require a lender approval to get that done. And my concern is going back to something we were talking about earlier. Now you start playing around with triggering some of the carve outs, and not disclosing that transfer of ownership of that size to the lender. You run the risk of triggering carve outs and a personal guarantee. That's what would concern me.
Understand, is there any way to get around the loan assumption, I guess, and pass the interest without going through the assumption if you've got a hot buyer? It sounds like membership interest might be one way if it's less than 25% is about the only loophole.
Well, if you're the seller, though, I mean, we could kind of hash stuff like this out, you know, all afternoon, I suppose, with hypotheticals. But in that scenario, if you're the seller, you're not going to want to leave your name on that loan, I don't think. I mean, you're unless you're maintaining some equity interest, and then at that point, really, you're just jostling around your equity. You're staying below the 20 or 25% threshold. you notify the lender of it. You know, you're working within the confines of the loan docs at that point. But as a seller, you're still staying in the deal, and you know, you're still a key principal in the transaction. So,
is another trigger notifying when there's a management company change, or can you just swap management companies without notifying?
Third-party management?
Yeah.
You would want to notify them of that change.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate it. Just a little bit of typically the smaller loans you can avoid. You can assume people's loans or step into the shoes of their financing putting it in a land trust. It sounds like it's a little bit more. There's more triggers and I understand this size loan that especially with multiple owners and possibly securitized LLC, that you just can't step into the shoes without getting permission. So then that's when the loan assumption is how you want to go.
That is true.
Very good. Thank you.
All righty. No problem. Thank you.
Okay. So let me read the two questions that were. I'll start with the first question. Is there a secondary financing available for the difference between the existing debt and the new purchase price, or is it all just in the raise?
Yes, there is. That's actually my next section that I was going to touch on was, one of the issues when you've paid that mortgage balance down and now the property's appreciated and the new buyer has to come in and they can assume a loan, but what if it's only at 60% leverage? You know, that is an issue. So yes, there is secondary financing available on some of them. It's not available on others. It's considered a supplemental loan, and Fannie Mae offers supplemental loans. Freddie Mac Conventional also offers supplemental loans, and there are certain parameters that are associated with them. I mean, they're not going to lever you back up automatically to 80%. It's going to depend on how much time is left on the loan. So in the event of an assumption, which is what we're talking about here, if you've got more than 7 years left on the term, then they will go up to 75% leverage, given an 80% market. They'll go up to 75% leverage. And if you've got between 7 and 5 years left, then they're going to max out at 65% on their leverage. And then below 5 years, they don't do the supplemental program. But as long as you've got at least 5 years left, they will do a sup loan for you. The rates on those sup loans are marginally higher than market rates at the time, you know, first mortgage rates, maybe 10 to 15 basis points higher. And they're coterminous with the existing loan. So if you've got 7 years left, they're going to structure a 7-year supplemental loan for you. But yes, to answer your question, Fannie and Freddie, they do offer them. Freddie's small balance doesn't currently offer a supplemental loan program. And in most cases, your conduit lenders do not offer supplemental loans. So that's where you don't see them, but they're a nice feature with Fannie and Freddie Conventional, definitely.
So. Okay, so the second question comes from Joe from San Diego. And he says, Eric, I recently came across a 150-unit property that has an assumable mortgage with an interest rate of 6%. The lender wants to charge me 5% for the remaining loan that is not assumable. If I continue with the property, does that mean my interest rate combined would be 11%? Can you explain how an assumption mortgage works, basically?
Well, yes. I'm not really clear on the scenario that he just described, though. So I'm gonna ask you to repeat that one. If he's going to assume a loan with a 6% interest rate.
Yeah.
And then he says where does the 5% come from?
Yeah, then he says the lender wants to charge him 5% for the remaining loan that is not assumable. So maybe that's that supplementary that they were talking about. that you were talking about. So that, then he wants to know if the combined interest rate will be like 11% with both programs working at the same time.
It depends. Well, you would need to do a calculation of the blended rate. Essentially, you're gonna what you would do is look at your payment. Let's say that is a 5% supplemental loan, and he's assuming a 6%. Well, it all depends on how much debt is at 6% and how much debt is at 5%. Essentially, you combine the two payments and then back into your present value for a blended rate. We could do a calculation on it, but that's, you know, that's something that's pretty simple to do with an Excel spreadsheet. You would look at your blended rate and see what it is. But like I said, it all depends on how much is at 6% and how much debt is at 5% to determine that.
Okay. Operator, did anyone like queue in for a question?
No, we have no live questions at the moment.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's pretty much the wrap up for my section of what I was going to touch on. The carve outs, we touched on the carve outs to the non-recourse guarantee. We mentioned that typically these securitized loans offer longer term relative to your portfolio lenders who are shorter term. With that longer term, we do see the heavier prepayment penalties, we see yield maintenance, and we see defeasance. And then, you know, a way to not incur those fees is through offering a loan assumption and going through those processes. And then if we need to lever up, if it's not enough debt that you're assuming, oftentimes you can do a supplemental loan and get the deal done that way. So that's kind of the overview of what we wanted to talk about.
I have about two questions.
Oh, you did?
Questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, they weren't on topic. That's why I threw that assumption one in there. All right, so here's a question. If someone sponsors a deal, okay, he's a sponsor, and he's getting 20% of the cash flow, 20% of the equity, and say the property is going for like $5 million. So if he goes to sponsor his next deal, what from that deal, the first deal, how much can he put down? How much did his net worth increase by doing that deal? Is it the purchase price, or is it the percentage of his what he's getting for his carve outs on the deal?
It's going to be whatever percentage drills down to his ownership. So if his carve out is let's just give a regular example. It's a 40% carve out, right? Your investors get 60, and your management team in general gets 40%, right? And his portion of that 40% is, let's say for his position in the deal, he gets 20% of the carve out. So he gets 20% of that 40, right? That means he's got an 8% ownership in the overall deal. That's going to drill down to 8% ownership of the overall deal. Now, of that 8%, a portion of it is debt, right? So what's going to drill down to his net worth is the equity portion of that 8%. So you can't really put the purchase price, you know, if you do a $10 million deal, you can't put your net worth isn't going to bump up by $10 million. If you do a $10 million deal and you have an $8 million loan on it and you own 10% of that asset, then your net worth is going to increase by 10% of that, by the 10% of the equity portion of that asset. So that's effectively what's going to go down on your financial statement is your percentage of the equity of that asset. Does that make sense?
Okay. Oh, that makes sense to me. So now the next one is there every time that a sponsor is, no is there or maybe is there ever a time that a sponsor is not required in the deal?
It all depends on the qualifications of who the key principals are and the qualifications of that person. One of the things I'd like to clarify about the term sponsor, anybody who is a key principal in the transaction and is getting underwritten by the lender and signs on behalf of the borrowing entity, they're considered a sponsor. You know, anybody that the bank is underwriting and is signing on the loan docs, your lender considers them a sponsor. We've, you know, in our business, we've used the term sponsor to indicate someone from the outside that comes into your deal and signs on the loan. That does make sense. But remember that from a lender's eyes, they're a partner in the deal. So if you're signing on the loan and it's your first deal and someone else is coming in with more experience, more net worth, liquidity, whatever the requirements are, whatever they bring to the table, they're also a sponsor. So, you know, it's to say, well, is there ever a scenario where a sponsor isn't required? There's always going to be somebody that signs on behalf of the company on these deals that we're doing. I mean, once you get into your institutions and, you know, your REITs are buying property, then no, you know, that's a different ballgame. But in the area that we play in, you know, this sub, for the most part, it's sub 25 million. There's typically a warm body that's associated with that deal. There's somebody signing on behalf of the loan. The experience level is somewhat gray. If I've got a client that has been buying property in their backyard and they've got extensive single family experience and real solid financials and the deal's working well, I can sell that experience in the marketplace and get that loan for them done for them. If it's someone that is maybe they've got a credit hiccup or you know, they don't bring the same financial wherewithal that's required in the deal, or they're buying outside of their footprint area and haven't done that before, then that is when you typically see someone else come in, or that's when you would bring somebody else into your partnership that would round out your team on those qualifications. So the answer to the question is yes, there are scenarios where that individual we call a sponsor is not required. But that's all relative to the deal, meaning, you know, the size of the transaction, the property condition, the property performance, the property location. So we could create a scenario for both. I typically see them get done with partnerships, you know, people coming in, taking advantage of the network, taking advantage of the mastery program, and you know, rubbing elbows, finding like-minded individuals to form partnerships, and leveraging that experience. You know, because yes, we want to get loans approved. Yes, we want to get loans done. But the real value of sponsorship, as we call it, is bringing somebody else on your team that knows what they're doing, can add value to the day-to-day operations, and help make that investment a success. Because when it's a success for you, it's a success for the lender. So, you know, you guys are on the same side of the transaction. And that's what I see. As far as sponsorship goes, that's my position on it. We could create a scenario where you wouldn't need one, but typically that's how I see deals get done, is people forming partnerships and working together. So.
All right. So Cindy from Dallas writes in, can you please explain a bridge loan? I was recently told I needed a bridge loan for a property that didn't meet the whole eternity. I'm not sure why a bridge loan was necessary. If you can explain when you need a bridge loan and why.
Sure. Bridge loans are typically, they're associated with a couple different scenarios. One, a bridge loan is defined by the term. So it's going to be, in most cases, bridge loans are 24 months or less. They are, in most cases, they're interest only, meaning you're not going to reduce the principal down, or you're not going to make monthly payments onto the principal. You're just going to pay interest. And they are typically associated with properties that are unstabilized, meaning the occupancy isn't where it needs to be to secure permanent financing, say in the mid-80s or higher. Or possibly you need to close quickly and you don't have the time to underwrite the deal, or you don't have the historical financial information available to secure permanent debt. Or a third scenario is you may not want to hold it that long. You may not want to place Fannie Mae debt on your property and have to incur a yield maintenance prepayment penalty when you want to sell it early. In all three of those scenarios, it lends itself to a shorter-term loan. So that specific property that you were referencing, where you may need to get bridge financing on it, it didn't meet the Holy Trinity, most likely they're talking about the cash flow. It probably didn't throw off enough cash because it wasn't stabilized, or the occupancy was so low it didn't make enough money to meet that 1.6 debt service coverage ratio. And you would secure secure the property or buy the property using the short-term financing, stabilize it, meaning stabilize the performance, bring the occupancy up, get it running where you want it, and then refinance into permanent debt after you stabilize the property. So that would be the perfect use of a bridge loan.
Okay, two more, and then we have two people in the queue. What conservatively can you get for an interest rate right now for multifamily property?
Your interest rate is going to be defined by your term. So the longer you fix your interest rate, the more expensive your interest rate is going to be. We can do a one-month adjustable rate at 3.5 or 3.6%, but it's going to adjust every month. 10-year money is anywhere from 4.75 to 5.25. That's going to be affected by the size of the loan, the type of prepayment penalty you put on it, who the lender is, whether it's Freddie small balance or Freddie conventional, that type of thing. So there's a lot of contributing factors, but in general, rates are say between 4.75 and 5.25. The best thing to, when you're estimating rates like that, the best thing to watch is the 10-year treasury. That's gonna be a real solid indicator for where your permanent rates are going to be. And in most cases, the spread or the difference between market interest rates and the treasury is about 2.5%. So wherever you see that 10-year treasury, it should be around 2.38, something like that. You add about 2.5% to that, and that's just a general, eyeballing of where that 10-year money is going to be. So it's kind of a general range.
Okay, and then, what's the best way to underwrite a property when it has seller financing?
Well, I mean, you're gonna underwrite to market rates, and one of the things when you're utilizing seller financing, it can be real valuable, but what happens a lot of times is you have a propensity to do two things. One, you have a tendency to lever up as high as you can, so you get in with as little amount of equity as you can. And if you do that, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but you want to make sure that you give yourself enough time to increase the value of that property to the point where you're able to refi out. If you were to take, say, a 90% financing and get in with 10% seller financing up to 90% and get in with 10% equity, let's say you only took a year term on that financing, you have to really, really consider where market rates are on your refi. If you're only able to get 75% leverage for a cash out refinance on that deal, then you're going to be over leveraged at the time you have to refinance out. So I would ask you to be very, very cautious of where market rates are, and you know, dial that back just a little bit because you are forecasting, and don't over leverage. Also, don't skimp on your third party reports. You know, your lender requires an appraisal, they require an environmental, and they require a property condition assessment so they can adequately protect their investors and you know, do their standard due diligence on the property. And I would ask you not to steer too far away from that because you can really get yourself in a bind if you don't do your proper environmental and do your healthy third parties. You know, you owe that to your investors as well. Standard market would be a 1.25 to 1.35 debt service coverage ratio. Standard amortization in the multifamily world is a 30-year amortization. And most lenders do not underwrite to interest-only payments right up front. They underwrite to principal and interest payments. So that's how I would underwrite the deal. Also, I wouldn't underwrite to a refinance at 80%. I would consider 75% max leverage on a cash out refi. That's typically market. So those are just some guidelines you can use when you're going into seller financing deals.
Good stuff. Okay, operator, who do we have in the queue?
Okay, up next we have Andre. Andre, please go ahead.
Oh, hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. This is Andre Williams from L.A. Basically, you did answer my question earlier. It was about, is there any way that, is there any option for a new master's student to purchase a property without a sponsor? And because I know I have a real good one I'm working on right now. I sent it to my coach, Craig, and he said it looks good to go, and so I'm working on it real hard.
Well, good. And yeah, that's always really comes down to the property itself and how it relates to your experience. You know, if you've got some single family history in the market, if it's close to you, if you're, you know, financially strong relative to the loan that you're asking for, and you're going to use third party management, well, there's a chance we can get that done. If it's something that, you know, is across the country. You know, if you're out in LA and you're buying a property in Boston, and you know it's maybe it's got a lot of value add to it, which as an investor you really like that. You know, we all look at properties that have a ton of upside and things that we can fix, and we get excited about that as equity investors. From a lender standpoint, they don't see a whole lot of that appreciation. Well, they don't see any of the appreciation. You know, as long as that property can be refinanced at the end of the term, they're happy. So they don't focus as much on that upside as we do. And, you know, you get excited about it. They, on the other hand, want to see a little bit more of a conservative approach. They want to look at historicals. So, you know, it's really case by case.
Okay. Eric, if it's performing strongly, you know, actual numbers that are performing strongly, then it's a good deal. So would that be an extra added, I guess, reason to do the deal with us as opposed to us getting a sponsor if we don't have that much experience?
For you personally, and from a borrower standpoint, if you haven't done it before, you know, if you haven't operated a multifamily property or managed the manager, you know, take for your first deal or second deal, there's a lot of value in having someone else on your team that has done that before. You know, I'm not saying it's mandatory because obviously every deal is different, but I think there's a lot of value in it. Depending on the financial strength, your lender may require it because, you know, they do have certain guidelines that they need to meet. But if if it's a financially strong borrowing team, property's running well, and we've got some level of experience behind us, oftentimes I can sell that to a lender, you know, and they'll get it done.
Right.
Zero experience, you know, financial strength that's just qualifying, that's a lot harder of a sell. So
okay.
We have to look at it and see what we're, have to look at a deal and see what we're really working with.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the question.
Okay, up next we have Zach. Zach, please go ahead.
Hey guys, this is Zach up in Chicago. Eric, thanks for your time today. This has been great. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Zach.
Yeah, appreciate it. I just have a more general question. So when we're talking about these loans, we talk about, you know, the term of the loan, 10 years, 15 years, and then we also talk about the amortization period, you know, typically 20, 25, 30 years. I was just curious, how do those two things combine to determine the, you know, the payment structure, the payment amount, and the total loan amount?
Your amortization and your interest rate, is that what you were referring?
Yeah, so like, well, you know, there's the term of the loan, say a 10-year fixed period, right? And then there's, you know, 30-year amortization period.
Right.
So how do those two things combine to, you know, determine the final structure of the loan? What does that mean for us in terms of you know, payment amount and structure and timeline?
Okay. Well, the amortization is the number of months that your payment is divided up, right? So if you have a 25-year amortization or a 20-year amortization, your payment is going to be higher than if it was spread out over 30 years or 360 months. So the longer the amortization, the lower the payment in that respect. The term is the length of time that the loan is going to be in place. So at the end of the term, the loan's going to balloon or mature, and you've got to pay it off. You've got to pay up that lump sum. If it was fully amortized with no balloon, then it would run down to a zero balance at the end of the 30 years, and you know there would be no balloon on it. But the basically having a 10-year term means we're going to have to refinance that loan at the end of 10 years, 120 months. Then the third component there is your fixed period. So the length of time that you're asking a lender to fix the rate, meaning not change the interest rate, the longer the fixed period, the more expensive that rate usually is. So, and then that's basically a function of you asking an investor to hold their rate for a longer period of time, they're taking on interest rate risk, so they're going to charge more to compensate for that risk.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. And then so in terms of the just purely the amortization period, having a shorter amortization period, meaning higher payments, That doesn't mean that the total amount you pay in over the course of the loan is any different. It's still going to be the same. It'll just be when it balloons, you'll have a lower amount due because you've been paying in a higher amount. Is that correct?
Well, you're going to reduce your principal at a faster rate.
Right.
So that's, you know, let's say on your investment side and how this whole balancing, because that's what it is, the balancing act, how this whole balancing act plays out is if you, let's say there's the economic life of the property is a little bit sketchy, right? It's not in the best of conditions. And to compensate for that, your lender comes in and says they only want to do a 25-year amortization. Well, your payments are going to be higher and your principal reduction is going to be faster because every month you're going to pay more towards that principal. So yes, you're paying it down more, and then when you do sell that property, your principal balance is going to be lower, So there's going to be a higher percentage or a higher amount that's given back to you. So that principal reduction does come back to you, but one would say that you know, keeping that money in your pocket, a lower payment is going to return your cash flow or open up your cash flow. In most cases, the longer amortization is going to be better for you for your investor returns.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. All right. That'll make sense. I appreciate it, Eric. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Okay. Eric, do you have time to take two more questions?
We have two more questions.
Yes. If not, then we could it's up to you. I'm not sure what your time frame looks like.
No, we're good. I'm good.
All right. Okay, operator, we're ready.
Okay, up next we have Christy. Christy, please go ahead.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, Christy.
Hey, sorry, I know I'm going to talk to you later, but I just thought, people would want to know the answer because it's kind of general. So when we analyze the deals, we have to do a lot of them before we secure the LOI and, send it to you for the loan package. But when we run the number, when we put in the interest rate and the down payment, what should we put there for a general term? And also, would you want to look at the deal at that point, or is that too early? Or how do we carry out these due diligence upfront so that it saves us time and be more efficient in the process?
That's a great question, right? Eric, when we were I was gonna have you give out your contact information, when to engage you, when to what do you want to see in a deal, if there's anything that you need up front, stuff like that, size of the deals that you do, things like that. So I don't know if you want to do that now as part of Christy's answer, but she wants to know what to underwrite at too. So I was going to include that at the very end so I don't repeat myself on that, having you do that. So you can did that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And okay. Christy, I think that the two questions there, I'm going to have you ask me the first one you asked about where to underwrite. Ask me that again because I want to make sure that I get the specifics on it. The second part of that question was kind of the chronology of, when do you send it in and when do we get the deal scrubbed and whatnot. The most efficient way to go about it, and what I like to do with all of the mastery students and my other clients as well, is start with an initial consultation, right? And we'll sit on the phone, just like what we're going to do this afternoon. Sit on the phone and kind of go over your markets that you're looking at, go over the loan sizes, the types of asset, meaning stabilized or unstabilized, that type of thing, and really drill down what type of financing you can expect on that deal. And once we do that, you'll know what to dial in. I mean, the RE Mentor templates are built so that you can plug in a couple numbers and you can see the debt service coverage ratio. You can see what your cash on cash return is. I mean, they're really comprehensive spreadsheets, so they allow you to go in and do this quick analysis as long as the data that you're putting in is accurate. So that initial consultation is really important, and then you know what to dial in, so you're doing your own analysis and you put your LOIs out. As you said, you're going to go through a lot of LOIs. You're going to scratch your head, question your own numbers. I'm sure everybody's done that, where you question your own numbers. Because that broker sounded really confident about what he was saying, but it just doesn't line up. And there's usually a reason why. So before you actually put that purchase contract out, let's say you get that LOI accepted, before you put that purchase contract out, I really like to talk to you again and just kind of have a refresher on the deal, look at some of the nuances of it, tenant, specialty tenant base, anything like that. And then you go under contract, and after that we're talking every day. So that's kind of the chronology of it, is the initial consultation, know what to dial in, you know, go out there, you get your LOI accepted, then let's talk again. But I mean, and again, I'm always available for phone calls. I'm on the phone all day long, so I don't have a formal structure where you have to call me at a certain time or something like that. Just give me a ring whenever. So.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
And then what was the second part as far as what kind of information to use or what to dial in?
I think it's like the down payment or either 25 or 30 or 20.
Sure. Standard for the market is a 20% equity injection. You know, that's kind of your national average. Multifamily deals are, you know, usually 80-20. So 80% loan, 20% equity injection. In certain markets, and depending on which lender we're going to go with, you know, like let's say we go with Freddie Mac in a smaller market, then they can scale back to 75%. A lot of that's going to be we're going to vet out on your initial consultation, and
okay.
You know if you come back and say, you know, everything I'm doing is in Houston, and I'm working with $8 to $10 million loan requests in Houston, then, you know, either Freddie conventional or Fannie Mae is going to be your best bet. Well, Fannie Mae requires that they see the deal first before we go over 65% leverage. I'm just giving you an example. So we would need to get a waiver above that. I mean, I've done deals at 80-82% in the Houston MSA, but they're exceptions to the norm. So as long as we vet it out first and get those exceptions, then we're going to be in good shape. So that's what we talk about on the initial consultation of what you should dial in.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have one more, right?
We have no further questions at the moment.
Oh, okay. So, all right. So, all right. So we're done. We're done with this call. And like you went over how to engage you and like so that's good. But what about your contact information? Because I'm not sure if you gave that out or not, so that people can contact you.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I appreciate that. My company name is Atlantic Business Capital, and I'll give you my phone number. It's 1-800-916-9005. Again, 800-916-9005. Feel free to email me at E Stewart, which is my first initial, E and then STEWART, at AtlanticBusinessCapital.com. And I'm just in the process of updating our website, putting some calculators on there adding a lot more functionality to it. So you know, feel free to visit the site, but we're in the process of updating it. So give me a ring with any questions, anything we didn't touch on the call, or if you want to dive into something further, please feel free to let me know.
All right, that's great. And I'll tell you, like Eric goes out there and he gets deals done. He can be he knows like all different programs out there, so he can be creative. He knows what Freddie Mac is doing. So. But like, respect his time and stuff. Don't just like shop with him and shop some other lender and stuff like that. Because this guy's the real deal. He's out there and he knows what you're looking for. And it's like he's been with us. He's been at the events that you guys were all been going to, all the UPs and all that stuff. He knows our investors. He knows our sponsors. He knows a lot. So he's like a wealth of knowledge and stuff. Just respect his time. But like he said, he's free if you want to call him up. So he's a good guy. He's a regular guy to talk to, as you can tell. And like, take advantage of it. That's why he's on our power team. So, Eric, thanks for the call. You were great. Really good.
Thanks. Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate you having me.
All right. Take care. And take care to everyone else who's on the call. Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.